My name is Paul Bosch, and we're taking a look at the arts as they relate to worship this week. And the topic is today is the last of a series, talking first about the arts of space and architecture, then the arts of drama and theater and movement and posture and gesture, then the arts of words and language yesterday, and today the arts of symbols and what I call signs or artifacts. And we're going to take a look at them in a minute, but I'm going to do something I've never done before, and that is read to you. It'll take maybe 10 minutes. An essay that I wrote in preparation for this class today, I took a look at this essay that I wrote a couple years ago, and I said, boy, that's so good, I just have to use every word. So if you will allow me, I'm going to read this, and then we'll have some discussion, okay? I'll interrupt myself as we go along, too. And the title of the essay is Enlarging the Sign, Worship and the Hunger for Primary Experience. Martin Luther talked about enlarging the sign, for instance. At baptism, he wanted to dunk. He wanted to immerse, because he thought the little dabs of moisture on a baby's brow is just not a sufficient symbol of the richness of baptism. Much better if you're drowned and rise again in those waters. And he talked about enlarging the sign at Holy Communion. Back in his day, of course, people just had the bread, and the bread was just a little wafer. It didn't even look like bread. So Luther says, let's enlarge that sign. Let's have real bread, and let's let the people have the cup too, not just the priest. So as you know, those changes were made. So I'm calling this essay Enlarging the Sign, Worship and the Hunger for Primary Experience. And I wrote this essay for the Canadian Church and the Canadian Lutheran Church. And the Canadian Lutheran Church published this essay along with a whole bunch of other very, very interesting and significant essays. And you could write to the home office in Winnipeg if you want to get a copy. Anyhow, I'm going to read it, as I say. I don't like to do that because it's not quite so lively, but I'll make it lively. Introduction. Christian worship reflects an incarnated faith, and one implication of this reality is its devotion to the principle of the critical importance of sign and symbol in what we do. Luther himself would be the first to acknowledge the teaching function of much that we might identify as adiaphora. Adiaphora is a fancy word that you learn in seminary, and it means a bearer of kind of neutral importance. It carries with it, it's something that carries with it neither a command nor a rejection. So such things as music, gesture, vestments, architectural setting, from one perspective, that's all adiaphora. I have the word up there on the board. And adiaphora means it's not commanded, it's not rejected, it's just there. Doesn't matter, for instance, if the pastor preached the gospel dressed in a bathrobe and pajamas, right? If it was the gospel. On the other hand, if the pastor is there in bathrobe and pajamas, he's got some explaining to do. So I'm arguing all the course of this week that what you're wearing and the way you stand and the way you sit and all that stuff does indeed teach. And Luther himself would be the first to acknowledge that there is a teaching function, even though we call it adiaphora, even though it's of secondary concern to us, even though it doesn't say in the Bible that you're supposed to wear an alb and a stole, even though that stuff is, in a sense, adiaphora, kind of neutral bearing, music, gesture, vestments, architectural setting. Nevertheless, all these are languages which human beings utilize to express themselves and to communicate. What we do and how we do it cannot fail to teach. What we teach by what we do is the subject of this essay, and indeed the subject of all rubrics or directions for Christian worship. And I pointed out how the service books, including the green book that you're used to from the last 20 years, and also this new book, the rubrics are the little directions that are printed in red. They're like the stage directions, and they're not unimportant. That happens almost every day.
That's the bus.
Is that what it is? It's for the bus. That must be it. Sure. Okay. You've solved a mystery for me. Very good. Thank you. What we teach by what we do, therefore, is the subject of all rubrics or directions for Christian worship. And I think I quoted to you a couple days ago one of my teachers who says, if we have the rubrics down right, if we know what we're supposed to be doing in worship, then the words will be there. It's almost as if you don't need the texts. We'll have the words. Hence, our unapologetic concern here with adiaphora and with the importance of signs and symbols in worship. Further, we in the West, that is Western civilization, Western Europe and North America particularly, in the first world, live in an age of cultural inflation. Have you ever heard that term before? Cultural inflation. Our senses are assaulted daily by visual and oral and even tactile stimuli. Music washes over us in the shopping mall. Have you noticed that? In the supermarket, in the dentist's waiting room. I mean, you can't escape it. Visual images, chiefly from television and chiefly commercial in intent, wanting you to separate you from your money, assault our eyes and lodge stubbornly in our subconscious. Not surprisingly, we have learned to tune out. What's the result when you have all that inflation, all that stuff coming at you?
You turn off your ears.
You turn off. I do the same thing. I got hearing aids and I just tune them out. And we get very cynical. That's my last sentence in this paragraph. We have all become culturally and aesthetically cynical in the process. We think everybody's trying to sell us something, right? So we just don't pay attention. The poor artist who's painting pictures or making music, you know, they got to compete with all that cultural inflation. Further still, this was all introduction. Further still, we modern Western Christians, in our intoxication, one might even say idolatry, of innovation and technology, have largely succeeded in insulating ourselves against primary experience by interposing secondary, second-hand substitutions. Why do you suppose a service like last night's Vespers is so moving to you? Did you find yourself moved by that service last night with the candles and all that? Wonderful. Why is that so gripping and so moving? Because we're at primary experience. We don't have any electric lights. It's candlelight. You know, you're brought back to the time of your grandfather and grandmother. You're in touch with something very real and very basic. I'm arguing here in this paragraph that we are intoxicated and even idolatrous about innovation and technology in the West, particularly Western Europe and North America, and we are constantly interposing secondary and second-hand stuff, insulating ourselves against what is authentic. Plastic or silk flowers that never die. I mean, they're lovely, but in church, I think I'd want to have the real thing. I'd want to have real flowers in church, not plastic, not silk. Electric candles that flicker at the touch of a switch. Have you seen them? They not only glow like a candle, but they even flicker. But they're electric. Crazy. Electronic keyboard instruments that simulate pipe organ sounds. Electronic public address systems that amplify and distort the human voice. Even wall-to-wall carpeting. Each of these quote-unquote modern technological innovations is most often nothing but an unfortunate, if well-intentioned, mistake when applied to the needs of Christian worship. They usually serve only to insulate worshipers, to distance us from experiencing what is truly authentic. And I heard, do you know the name Reuel Howe, some of you old-timers or some of you pastors? Reuel Howe is a wonderful Anglican Episcopal preacher, written a couple of books, The Miracle of Dialogue and some others. And I heard him say one day, we should tear up the carpeting in the center aisle of our church, because what we're doing with that carpeting is insulating ourselves against hearing the sound of the click of those heels of the people who are going up to communion and coming back. And he says, that sound proclaims the gospel. And we insulate ourselves against it. Now, you can argue with me, and I'll give you a chance here in a few minutes. Nevertheless, there remains within us a deep cultural hunger for what is authentic, for the things that matter, a yearning for contact and engagement with the heights and depths of human life. In a word, we are simultaneously overfed, all that muzak and all that stuff bombarding us every day, and undernourished. In our plastic age, we are overfed with that which does not satisfy. We know what's phony. A voice on a PA system is just phony. It's not the real person. Wasn't it nice last night, again, talk about primary experience. Wasn't it nice when Jeannie, the choir director, just sang out without that mic? I hate that mic. Do you do with your hearing aids? Boy. Now, granted, you may need mics in some places, and all technology has its place, I suppose. And I'm, my Lord, I have not only hearing aids, I got an artificial heart valve. You know, so I think I want to honor technology, but it has a limited use in worship. We are overfed by that which does not satisfy, and we are undernourished, deeply hungering for the primary experience that our grandparents could take for granted. Further, these signs, these actions, these articles and artifacts of our tradition, candlelight, vestments, bread and wine, water, stuff like that, they carry three burdens of meaning, and I put them on the board too. The utilitarian, the symbolic or phenomenological or pedagogical, big fancy words there that I'll explain in a minute, and the historical. Let's take a look at each one of them. The utilitarian function is not often clearly enough displayed among us. The use of candles in worship, for example, is primarily, or was at first, primarily utilitarian. Candles are intended, first of all, simply to provide illumination for the worship leader's ministry. That fact should tell us something about how we use candles in our worship, their placement, their size, their scale. You ought to have candles at the reading desk, it seems to me. Lectern, pulpit, whatever. You ought to have candles at the altar, where you're going to have the meal in a few minutes. You ought to have candles at the seat where the presider sits with the book. And in the old days, again, it was just the presider, it was just the leader who was literate. Everybody else was illiterate, and that's not a bad thing. What do they say the percentage is in North America today of the functionally illiterate? A lot of people just cannot read. And other people got bad bifocals or whatever, you know, or for one reason or another they never learned to read, or they have a hard time with printed text and so on. Anyhow, so that's first, the utilitarian function. Same with vestments. What do vestments do? Well, they cover up my patched knee or my shiny trouser seat or my gaudy necktie or my rubber tire waistline. I mean, vestments have the advantage, you see, of taking away the idiosyncrasy of the leader and focusing on the event. That's utilitarian, strictly utilitarian function. Then, the symbolic or pedagogical or phenomenological function of these signs, candles, vestments, stuff like that, represents a teaching opportunity that we ignore to our diminishment. We silence an important voice. We muzzle a potentially eloquent witness when we are not sensitive to what these signs and gestures teach. And teach they do, whether or not we are aware of what they teach. Let's take flowers, for example. There's a long tradition in the church that you have flowers in the altar, or on the altar, or near the altar, or at the pulpit, or the lectern, or the baptismal font, or whatever. I think it's a great idea. One of the traditions is, in Lent and in Advent, you don't have flowers, you have just greens. And there you're allowing, you see, the florist's art to speak. Isn't that nice? If you have, for instance, all through those 7 weeks of Lent, nothing but, let's say, lemon leaves, or evergreen branches. Again, artfully displayed, you want to have a florist do it, or somebody with a florist's eye, a gardener. Isn't it nice to have flowers on the table here? Mm-hmm. You know, if you have nothing but greens during those 7 weeks of Lent, then Easter comes, wow, and there are the lilies and the hyacinths. I mean, it's marvelous. It's letting, in other words, it's letting the florist's art speak. I've even seen Ash Wednesday no flowers, no greens, just dried sticks. I mean, boy, would that affect you. And then on Good Friday, it's the suggested in our Green Book and in part of the ecumenical consensus, I would argue, nothing at all. No flowers, no greens, no vestments, no paraments, no altar symbols, no cross, no candles, nothing. The last act of worship on Holy Thursday, after you've had the scripture reading and the preaching and the foot washing and the Holy Communion, the last thing you do is empty out the chancel. You take everything out that's movable. So that on Good Friday and Holy Saturday, there's nothing there except what's nailed down, and it's very austere. It really gets you. Now, again, that's you have a teaching opportunity there that we forget about that we forget about it, and it's a pity we forget about it. When we attend to the importance of these signs, we are honoring an incarnational principle that is at the heart of Christian faith. God so loved the world. Again, it's a matter of first article of the Creed. Not incidentally, the verb in the Vulgate version of the Bible is the Latin version of the Bible, is not amo, loved, amo, amas, amat, remember from your Latin class, those of you who took Latin? But the verb instead is dilexit. Saw that at a Roman Catholic retreat center over the altar, this wonderful motto. And I began to puzzle it out. What did it mean? Sic Deus dilexit mundum. And I don't know a lot of Latin, but I knew enough to say, well, Deus, that's God, mundum, that's world. Sic, that means in this manner, or such, or so much. And then I put it together, oh, that's God so loved the world. John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. But this is what fooled me, dilexit. I was expecting amo, amas, amat. We get our word amorous from it. But this word, what do we get in English? Takes delight. Takes delight, isn't that nice? God so takes delight in the world.
Delicatessen.
What's that?
Delicatessen. Delicatessen.
Delicatessen, yeah, okay. Okay. But I kind of like that. God takes delight in the world so much that he sent his only son.
Well, in each one of the steps of creation, he saw what he made and he said, wow, it was
good. It was good, absolutely. Right. God saw everything he made and behold, it was very good. So we are dealing with the first article of the Creed here. We are dealing with important stuff. The historical function, that's the third, the historical function of these signs relates to our inherited traditions. And I talked about the Uffizi Gallery a couple of days ago. Did I give that illustration to you? About the do you know the Uffizi Gallery in, I guess I didn't, you're looking blank. Mm-hmm. I didn't use that, yeah. But some of you didn't hear this story. Do you mind if I repeat it? The Uffizi Gallery is in Florence, Italy, and it's an art gallery, and you've got some of the greatest art in the world there. Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Botticelli, I mean, some famous, famous names. And the story is told, I think it's apocryphal, but it's a great story, of this visitor who was walking through this, you know, practically at a run. Oh, I don't like that, and that painting is too dark, and that's no good. And the guide in the gallery couldn't take it any longer. And he said, sir, these paintings here are not on trial. You are. You are. And there's a sense in which the tradition judges us. So the historical function of these signs relates to our inherited traditions. We are living in an age of exciting ecumenical convergence, not least in a reappreciation in all Christian communities of the value of our common inherited traditions and our common historic roots. And I flash these books during my courses every day. The Baptism Eucharist and Ministry, this wonderful common statement of Orthodox, Catholic, Lutheran, United, Disciples, Baptist, Adventist, Pentecostal, Presbyterian, I mean, wonderful consensus statement about what worship is and how we ought to do it. And my own little book, What is Contemporary Worship? I have a little essay in here you might want to take a look. Anyhow, all the churches are coming to realize what a treasure we have in that tradition, the tradition that's represented in the Green Book, Lutheran version of it, and we ought to honor it. It is no accident that historic patterns and perceptions in worship have had enormous staying power. Many of these patterns and perceptions and signs and symbols and so on have fed the faith of Christian believers for literally hundreds of years. We do well today to regard them with some seriousness. They recall us to our holy history. I have a pastor friend who says, when I put on these vestments on Sunday morning, I am 2,000 years old. I like that, you know? Martin Luther would recognize the alb and the stole and the chasuble. St. Francis would recognize it, 12th century. Maybe St. Augustine, 4th century, would recognize it. I mean, that's, you don't want to take that stuff lightly. Sure, it doesn't look like a talk show with Jay Leno or David Letterman. You know, it doesn't look like what you see on TV. It doesn't look like a rock concert. But that's okay. It's a little different. And it's our responsibility then to invite people into those meanings, the utilitarian meaning, the phenomenological or symbolic or a pedagogical meaning, and even the historic meaning. Okay, the church as Holy Communion, and I mentioned this a couple days ago too. The gathered congregation is itself the chief sign and symbol in Christian worship. Our bodies, not our buildings, are the temples of the Holy Spirit. I think that's good to remember. We talk about the church being the house of God. You are the house of God. The church is the house of the people of God. The house of the church, they used to talk about in the first couple of centuries of faith. The house of the church is the body of Christ. And then you got to have a roof over your head when you gather, so we build a building. Care must be taken to ensure that the highest honor and reverence in our worship is directed toward the people themselves. More than that, the church itself, the Christian community, is the chief sacrament of Christ's presence. Roman Catholics are talking that way these days. The assembly at worship is the sacrament. The bread and the cup, sure, but also the people. Jesus says, "This is my body," referring to the bread, but I'll bet he's also talking about the disciples. "This is my body." The Christian assembly is itself the Holy Communion. It's a corporate noun. The Holy Communion refers to the action, it refers to the bread and the cup, but it also refers to you and me. Architectural signs. Beyond the assembly itself, however, are certain architectural signs and symbols important in worship, and what we might call artifactual signs. Remember the architectural signs from a couple days ago? Four. Go for it.
The altar.
Altar. Pulpit, lectern, whatever you want to call it. Ambo. The font for baptism. And the seat of the presider. Worship leaders. The font is one of the primary architectural signs in Christian worship. It is a place of washing, of death, and rebirth to newness of life. Although pouring, I'm only a couple more pages here and I'm finished. Although pouring and sprinkling remain familiar baptismal practices among Christians, Luther himself favored baptism by immersion as the fuller, the more primary of available baptismal signs. Three dabs of moisture on a baby's brow is probably sufficient for us to claim we've seen a valid and efficacious baptism. But that kind of sacramental minimalism, have you heard that word before? Minimalism. For a long time, a couple of generations, people were always asking, what's the least we can do to get away with, and it'll still be valid. It'll still be efficacious. So you have a little piece of wafer that, you know, instead of real bread, you have a little thing that some nun made that never goes bad. You can, that's this virtue, of course. You can store it in the cupboard there for weeks and weeks and months, and it never rots. But it doesn't look like bread either, or taste like bread. One of my friends says it requires two acts of faith when you come to Holy Communion, to believe that Christ is present here and then to believe that it's bread in the first place. It looks like fish food, you know, guppy food. Somebody said styrofoam. Now, it's handy. It's very handy. It stores, but I like the fact over here that they use real bread. And there's some nice recipes. If bread doesn't crumble. This bread has a tendency to crumble, but the recipe that I have, it makes a nice kind of a pita. You know what pita is? It's a Near Eastern loaf. And it has a cross in the middle of it and a mandala around it. It's very lovely, and it doesn't crumble. Okay, that kind of sacramental minimalism hardly suggests we're talking now about the waters at baptism. You know, three little dabs of moisture on a baby's brow. That kind of sacramental minimalism hardly suggests the fullness of the meaning of baptism. You know, Richard Kemmerer, crazy, wild man down at Grunewald Guild in Leavenworth, he's the guy who painted the ceiling in here, artist. And he goes around the country making lectures about this kind of thing. And he says, you go into most Protestant churches, and he says, you have to search before you can find the font. It's hidden over in some dark corner somewhere. When you finally locate it, you see that it's got a great big wooden witch's hat cover on it, and it gives two men a hernia to remove it. I mean, he's exaggerating, but it's great teaching. He says, when you take the cover off, what do you find? A little aluminum ashtray with a dead fly on the bottom. And he says, that can hardly suggest the fullness of baptism. So, we can rejoice that in our day, once again, as in an earlier age, congregations are reclaiming the fullness of the sign, enlarging the sign, by providing their worship spaces with substantial fonts with generous capacities for water. If I'd have thought of it, I'd have brought my slides from church architecture, and we'd have had a session. I didn't think of it. But some of the new fonts, like some of the old fonts, are great big things like this. St. Peter's in New York City, I described that, I think, a couple of days ago. First new church building of any denomination built in Manhattan Island in New York in 40 years. And their font, it's like a hot tub. It's like the jacuzzi. Great big font. And St. John's Collegeville, any of you Minnesotans been there? Oh, wonderful font, yeah. Marvelous. You have to go through a separate room before you get into the church. And here's this. I think it has running water in it, too. Lovely.
Same thing with Luther Seminary.
Luther Seminary, you're right.
That's a beautiful one.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. You're living in an age of baptismal rediscovery. All the churches are rediscovering baptism. Further, pastors and people do well to use some imagination in trying to reclaim at least some of the rich meanings associated with earliest Christian baptismal practice. Nude baptism by immersion. Now, I'm not sure our congregations are ready for that yet, but certainly infants can be baptized naked in a combination of immersion and pouring if the font is generous enough. I baptized our little granddaughter a couple of months ago in the font where my grandfather served and where I think my dad was baptized. This is Grace and St. Paul's in Manhattan, New York City. And they have a new redesigned church space with a lovely big font. And she was in a little diaper in her mother's arms before the baptism, you know, during the beginning part of the baptismal service. We took the diaper off and dunked her in the font and she squealed. And we poured water over her head and we took her out and wrapped her in a towel. And then she put on the alb of baptism. I described that tonight, the adult baptism. Of the early church, you took, even adults, you took off all your clothes, men and women separate usually, deacons taking men and deaconess taking women, different locations or different times, and you would take off all your clothes, earrings, jewelry, let your hair down, everything. It was a sign that you were rejecting that old life. Wonderful sign, right? Mm-hmm. You go down naked into that water. You come up on the other side and you put on a white alb. The same garment that they use over here on Sundays. And we could use any time. And lay people can use it too, not just the pastor. I mean, it's the sign of your baptism. And our little baby, when I baptized her, we put on a christening gown, as they called it in those days, that my grandfather wore. And what it is it's an alb for a little baby. And it's all full of lace and everything, you know. But I mean, it was handmade. And my grandfather used it, my father used it, I used it. And my siblings, my daughter and her siblings and cousins and, that generation and now the next generation, all in that same christening gown. Certainly, adults can be baptized naked in a combination of immersion and pouring, if the font is generous enough, and adults might remove at least some articles of clothing, a shirt or a jacket, suggesting, as anciently, the putting off of the old life of sin and death to be clothed after baptism in the white garment of baptism. Whatever the methods of baptism, copious amounts of water should be used. When a baptism is over, as a friend of mine says, the janitor should know that something's happened. I kind of like that. He's going to have some mopping up to do. In the course of a Christian baptism, the congregation, the candidate, and the simply curious should have been brought face to face with our most primary reality as baptized human beings, nothing less than new life out of death. There is a potent holy energy at work in baptism. Too often we trivialize baptism, not just baptism, but other sacraments too, everything we do in worship. We trivialize it by our over-scrupulousness for largely first world, largely middle class proprieties. See if this doesn't sound like North America or Western Europe. The tidy, the sanitary, the convenient, the decorous, the practical, the efficient. Those are never the first considerations in worship. If it's tidy, or if it's practical, or if it's efficient, or if it's decorous, or if it's convenient. You may want to get to that sooner or later, but first you want to let the sign speak. As a result of such fastidiousness, the awesome and awful and holy and sometimes messy mystery evaporates before our eyes. The altar, just a couple more paragraphs here. The altar is another of the chief architectural signs in Christian worship. As with other signs and symbols, the altar is first of all utilitarian. It is the family table around which the Christian community gathers to share the bread and the cup in the Lord's Supper. The pulpit, or lectern or ambo, is still a third architectural sign, a place where the word is read and proclaimed. The presider or leader's chair, or sedilia, from the Latin seat, sedilia, seat, is a fourth. Here is the place for the leadership of prayer and praise. And I talked last time, did I not, about ritual clarity. I think churches do their congregation a favor if they keep the altar for the meal. Don't use the altar for morning prayer or evening prayer. Just use it for Holy Communion. And in the Holy Communion service, don't go to the altar until the offertory, when you're going to set the table. Coventry Cathedral, any of you been to Coventry in England? Mm-hmm. Great, long, narrow, new building. The old one was bombed out. And they have a procession at the offertory that includes not just the money in the offering place, but the bread and the wine, and would you believe, the tablecloth and the candles. They have a great big procession, and they set the table for the meal at the time when everybody sings, you know, let the vineyards be fruitful, or the equivalent. Each of these architectural signs has its own utilitarian and symbolic and historic integrity. The use of the altar, for example, might well be restricted to its serving as family table during the Holy Communion and not used at all during other services. I just said that. The use of the lectern might be restricted to its serving as a place for reading and proclamation. Pastors do their people a favor when they keep firmly in mind these architectural and ritual principles: table, holy meal, bread and cup. Font, holy bath, water. Pulpit, holy word, Bible. Artifactual signs. Now, this is an invented word by Paul Bosch. The chief artifactual signs are, I got 15 of them. Write these down. No, you don't have to. The Bible of our preaching, the bread and the cup of Holy Communion, the water and the oil and the candle and the alb of baptism. All of those are signs in baptism. The Vesper candle of evening prayer. They have one over here, but they don't use it the way it ought to be used, in my view. You ought to carry that in when you have Vespers and sing that wonderful hymn to the light. Christ is the light of the faithful. It's a wonderful thing. Anyhow, the Vesper candle, and then the Paschal candle, that great big decorated candle that stands at the font, that's a version of the Vesper candle, and that's carried in at the Easter Vigil, lit all during the Easter season as a sign of the risen Christ, and then after the Easter season is over, Pentecost, you put it at the font, unlighted. But then you light it again if you have a baptism or if you have a funeral. other candles, the worship leader's altar book, the altar cross or processional cross, the minister's vestments, paraments and banners, flowers and greens, and even the graphic design of the bulletin or the guide to worship, you know, that you get from the usher at the door. That's one of the signs. In fact, it's the one sign that you can take away after the service is over and mail home to your mother. I used to tell students that. Take it home and mail it to your mother to show that you've been to church. Each of these signs as well has its own utilitarian and symbolic and historic integrity. A common loaf, let's talk about that for a minute. A common loaf of bread and a common cup of wine, for example, are essential and indispensable signs of our oneness, our communion in Christ. It could be argued in this respect that, quote, individual communion wafers, unquote, and individual communion cups represent ritually an intolerable contradiction in terms. If it's individual and it's not communion. You know what I'm saying? Pity. We deny, in other words, in our symbolism, we deny the message that we're preaching. So I would argue that even if you have to have individual glasses and even if you have to have individual wafers for the people's communion, on the altar, the minister ought to have a common loaf and a common cup, to remind people of the oneness that they are willing to deny when they come to eat and drink. You're going to jump on me, aren't you? Well, let's see. Two more paragraphs, then we'll talk. Congregations will want to make certain, therefore, that whatever the local practice in the communion of the people, a common loaf and a common cup will be utilized at the altar during the great Thanksgiving for ceremonial fullness. Of course, almost every Christian assembly will include people who are alcoholic or allergic to wine. Equally, our assemblies will likely contain persons allergic to the gluten or yeasted wheat bread. Pastors and worshipers, therefore, do well to recall that the total Christ is present in either sign, either the bread or the cup. The so-called doctrine of concomitance, and I put that word on the board 2 days ago. It will be sufficient, that is, for you to receive either the bread or the cup alone, when you cannot, for medical reasons, receive both. This would seem to resolve the issue with more compassion and less embarrassment for all than to provide alternate food, such as rice, bread, or grape juice, in alternate containers, such as individual glasses. End of speech. You want to jump on me? Go ahead.
No, I think that's very wholesome, very, very wholesome. And I find out that I belong to Trinity in Tacoma. There's been a freedom to have either the old or the new. But the old seems to be, although at first people didn't have it, the old seems to be winning out.
Oh yeah, I'm not surprised.
It seems as people simply...
wonderful staying power.
They simply... vote with their feet. They didn't have a chance to vote otherwise, but
sure.
And it's always controversial, but this way they have a choice and they do it that way.
There's some great new stuff, there's no question about that. But there's also a lot of probably mediocre stuff, and it will take history to be the final judge. I mean, we will not know. And the neat thing about the Green Book, let me grab a copy. The neat thing about the Green Book is that much of it has passed that test of time. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of the stuff in here has not yet passed the test of time. But some of it will. Some of it is wonderful. That hymn, I think, that we sang this morning. Boy, that's a lovely hymn. That's going to last.
I was reading in a French magazine called Le Monde de Bible, the World of the Bible, that in early France, they're having the anniversary of the baptism of Clovis, the first king of France. And so they had a volume involved in that they actually had three structures in places, even in Trier, Germany, that they would have the church. That's all that we really have left. But they had a baptistry.
That's right.
And they also had an assembly for the people who were going to become
the catechumens,
Christians.
Interesting.
So that that was the old way in which Christianity came to those people up there in Europe.
Wonderful.
And Easter, then, when you were, after you had been instructed, then
you went to the baptistry.
That's right. Yeah. And that was also confirmation. It wasn't something special.
That's right.
And then you went to communion.
In another building.
It was Easter night. But we try to do too many things, and we try to let the unimportant things become the most important.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It comes as a surprise to a lot of people. What Ralph has been saying reminds me of the architecture that you can still see in Europe in some places. It comes as a surprise to a lot of people to learn that the Leaning Tower of Pisa is a bell tower at a campus of a church that includes at least two of those three buildings. Mm-hmm. There's a church building, the Cathedral of Pisa, which is, 9th century? I mean, it's very, very old, Romanesque. And a baptistry, separate building, and then this bell tower, and the bell tower is leaning over, and you know that's the famous thing there. But the baptistry is wonderful. Have you been in it? I mean, it's huge. It's a big room like a church, and it has a big hot tub type of font where people were dunked.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
And then the church building is still another building, and that has the altar and the pulpit and so on.
Some of the divisions between clergy and between some of the congregations have somewhat altered, though. I was in a little church in southern Germany that was very, very old.
And in southern where?
In southern Germany.
Ah.
And it had the upper part of the church was for the upper class people, and the lower part of the church were for the servants and the peasants. And it was interesting that, yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know when that disappeared, but years ago it was...
Some of those European cathedrals, too, have what's called a leper's squint. Have you heard about that? It's a separate little room, and there's a little squint, a little hole, a little slit, where the lepers would go, and they could go in that room, and they could peek through that squint to see the action of the Mass. And in the synagogue, of course, I think in the Orthodox synagogue to this day, it's just men, and the women have to be behind a screen. But let me tell you, it's not so old, my dear friends. My wife's family is Slovak background from the old country, and there are churches, at least the church that my wife grew up in, where in the old days the men sat on one side of the aisle and the women sat on the other.
So when I went to church, that's the way I was brought up.
You were, and you.
Right?
And my husband and I were one of the first ones. I ventured finally over to the men's side.
Oh, I bet you got a lot of criticism.
Yeah. Just getting started on that.
Yeah. No. Would you not agree that that's not a good thing? I mean, to have the rich here and the poor down there, that's no good. And to have the women behind a screen or on one side of the aisle and the men on the other, that's no good either. We ought to.
What is kind of nice, the way they have it open here, they can change the worship pattern.
Neat,
with
yeah.
The seating and so forth. And I know that, at PLU, we don't have a university chapel. They used to have one, but it doesn't really work except for drama and concerts. And so they've been worshiping in the university center.
Which university is this?
PLU, the Pacific
Coast really?
University in Tacoma. And therefore, Ed Martin and Susan were there with Dave Ehrman. So they did a lot of those things. And they once had a baptism, in which I'll never forget it, in which they just had poured water and water and water over the little boy. He was a
college student,
adolescent boy, mm-hmm. And they had the sponsors, and it was done with all of the symbolism, and the students just eat it up. It's not as if that's not popular.
Yeah, absolutely. And it speaks to you in the same way that this candlelight service did last night. Mm-hmm. You cannot fail to be affected by that.
Yeah.
May I say, on the board here are diagrams of the way we rearranged the space at Wartburg Seminary, because we had a chapel too, originally Oxford Movement type of neo-Gothic building back in 1912 when it was built with pews and an east wall altar and so on. There's a little picture above of what it looks like in its reconfiguration. This was a good 15 years ago. They tore out the pews, put in movable chairs, movable altar, movable pulpit, and the blue represents how we did it in Advent, the green how we did it in Epiphany, the purple how we did it in Lent, and the gold how we did it in Easter. Every season we had a different arrangement. I want to tell you about a baptism in a minute, but we have another hand.
In my congregation, we have a couple of interesting ways that we approach baptism. We have a big baptistry area with a font probably as big as this.
That you could dunk in.
For dunking, yeah. But we also, very seldom does anybody choose to do that, we also have a lake nearby. And we go to this lake, and it's quite an elaborate service because the people, the congregation is encouraged to go with, and you might have
go into the water with you.
Yeah, stand in the water, and it's cold. Or stand on the shore right behind the water and pray. And they pray loudly and they pray long.
Wonderful.
And then the person being baptized puts this white kind of sheet-looking, you know, thing over them, and it's symbolic, of course, and they tie a rope around the middle. And then they go out with whoever's going to be doing the baptizing and pray, and then they dunk them down and they come up, and then there's a lot of kind of rejoicing afterwards. And it's beautiful because they have the option of doing it inside. If somebody who maybe has been ill would want to do that in the warmer water, but the majority of people choose to go to the lake.
Wonderful.
And it really, and it's public. So it witnesses to the outside community that there is a baptism happening, and these people are there praying loudly.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, a crowd will sometimes watch.
Yeah, wonderful.
And it reminds me of what it must have been like with John the Baptist and Jordan, with a crowd watching.
Wonderful.
What's happening here. It's very powerful.
What community?
Where?
In Gig Harbor.
Oh.
That's where?
On about west side, about 200 miles.
Oregon? Washington?
Washington, yeah. There are a couple of lakes, and they've chosen...
Could be cold.
Yeah, kind of cold.
I thought you were talking about Florida.
No, my husband was baptized that way.
Is it Lutheran?
No, it's not Lutheran. It's not Lutheran. No, they're all adults, right?
We attended an old regular Baptist church when we were in Kentucky, if you were to give your life to Jesus that morning, they take you right down to the creek, which is right outside, and they dunk you.
They do a lot of singing, too.
Wonderful.
Yeah, nice.
But Aidan Cavanaugh is a liturgical superstar. He teaches at Yale, and he's written a lot of books, and he's probably one of the foremost authorities on Christian worship. And he has a wonderful article where he describes a primitive Christian baptism. And you take off your clothes, you go and you get dunked. You might, first of all, incidentally, stand. This is nighttime now, and you're standing on wild animal skins, bare feet, to show that, you know, this is the pagan wild world that you're rejecting. You take off all your clothes, you go down in the water in this, what might be a baptistry like the one at Pisa, a building, and the men are dunked by men and the women are dunked by women, you know, in separate places. You come up on the, and three times dunked, you know, this poor kid, he describes it as if it's a little kind of confirmand type age. And this kid doesn't quite know what to expect, and the bishop is in the water too with him. And he gets dunked three times, and he comes out and they dry him off and they oil him. It could even be a total body oiling. There's a wonderful video called, I think it's called This Is the Night, that's about Easter Vigil, the night before Easter, in a Roman Catholic parish in Texas, of all places. Very mixed ethnic congregation, but there are six or seven adult candidates who are to be baptized, and they have these kind of robes around them, so that it's still modest, you know, it's not immodest. But they get dunked in a big pool like this, they come up on the other side, they're dried off, they have oil poured over their heads. I mean, the guy has a pitcher. You see it on the video screen. And the oil just... what does the word Christ mean?
Anointed,
right. Oil. And the word Messiah in Hebrew, same thing. Anointed. And Cyril of Jerusalem is one of the early teachers of the church, and he says, how are we to call these people Christians if we do not oil them? anoint them. I never was anointed when I was baptized, you know, back in 65 years ago. But boy, when I do a baptism these days, I oil the baby or the adult.
Well, there are two churches in the neighborhood. One is a Lutheran one up in Little Chimicum, way out in the boondocks near Port Townsend, which has a wonderful fountain, which is nice. You can renew your baptism when you come into the church.
Nice.
And also the procession for communion goes past this so that the two sacraments are brought together. Do you ever get a chance to see that? It's Redeemer Church up there.
What's the community?
Chimicum, it's called. Chimicum Redeemer Lutheran, up there near Port Townsend, one of the nice tourist places. The other one is the Roman Catholic Cathedral St. James in Seattle. They have at quite an expense. They had arson set fire to, and they redid their church, and they did a very nice job. And what did they do in the central part of entering the church? It's a real dunking baptismal. And of course, the church was built not large enough for narthex. It should have more room, but they can use it. I've never seen them use it.
Wonderful.
But you can see it when you come in there.
Wonderful.
And so it's possible, even in an old place and in other structures, to bring forth of these. See, they redid our church in this is a long story, in Tacoma. It's a good church and it's a good congregation, but it looks like a funeral home now. Instead of like the old one. Well, see, the first committee wanted it, a man from St. Olaf, Sovik, gave them all the right sort of things the way you're doing it. But that cost too much. They wanted it all, you know what I mean? They didn't have the people following. They're good people, don't misunderstand.
Sure, sure.
There's nothing now of bad. They're all doing this in good faith. But nevertheless, what we've ended up with now, and it's all right, but I'm afraid that it's more like a funeral chapel with the carpeting and everything else.
Let me say a word about this oiling. My understanding is, again, in the ancient church where you would have had a baptistry as a separate building and then the church, the people in the church who are already baptized and who are members of the community, they're praying and singing, waiting for the baptism to take place in this other building. And little Evie Panamamdos, or whatever his name is, he's dunked three times, he comes out of the water, he's oiled, he's dried off, he puts on a white alb, and then he and the other candidates go, he's not oiled yet. He goes into the church building where the bishop confirms the fact that he was baptized by oiling him.
My uncle accidentally baptized with kerosene one time.
What's that?
My uncle accidentally baptized with kerosene one time. Back in the days when there was no water in church,
baptized.
And they would bring water in quart jars, little canning jars. Well, the water was brought for the baptism and placed on the window sill, but there also happened to be another jar that was standing there that had kerosene in it.
Ooh, right.
And the custodian takes the wrong one. And poor Uncle Willie, he said, I smelled that and I didn't know what to do. The whole baby had, it was all full of kerosene.
Oh, dear, dear.
So they had baptism after church service.
In southern Wisconsin, which is called by the Germans Die Kimmelkirche, because they didn't have enough wine for communion and they used kibble.
Wonderful.
You used what? Kibble, kind of a liqueur, you know.
Schnapps. Wonderful. But incidentally, this business of the baptism first and then.